They ripped the kids out of our arms and put them on the ground in this tent, and the police escorted us out of this compound.
An Alaska pilot ends up being detained in Haiti. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 22nd of February. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, Alaskans turn in strong showings today at the Olympics.
Oh, it was a great day. Another really solid performance.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Every day, people all over Alaska are discovering how public transportation benefits them, their businesses, and their communities. Public transportation in Alaska provides 7 million rides a year to work, medical appointments, shopping, schools, social opportunities, wherever people need to go. With public transportation available, the going is good. Find out more at goodgoingalaska.com. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Mobility Coalition, a nonprofit organization.
A Homer pilot who has been flying aid missions in and out of Haiti for the last 3 weeks ran into unexpected trouble last week when she was asked to help 6 legally adopted orphans to get to the United States. KBBI's Aaron Selbig has the story.
Stephanie Anderson, whose regular job is flying for Smoky Bay Air in Homer, got the call last Friday. 6 children, ranging in age from 1 to 5 years, were legally adopted by parents in Minnesota and waiting for a flight out of the country.
All of these kids have been in the adoption process, some of them for years, but all of them for months and months and months. They had all been approved and signed off by the Prime Minister of Haiti to be adopted in the U.S., and they all have adoptive parents waiting for them, and they all have U.S. visas.
With paperwork in hand from the United States Embassy, the flight should have been routine, says Anderson. When her party arrived at the Port-au-Prince airport with the children, however, things took an unexpected turn.
There's a huge line outside the airport. So I get in the line, and the other 2 women wait with the children in the shade on the other side of the driveway into the airport. And they get attacked by an angry mob accusing them of trafficking Haitian children. About 20 men aggressively, verbally attack them and physically walking them backwards and trying to take the children from them. They're screaming at them. It was a very aggressive scene. So the police show up and they take all of us, all 6 kids and 3 of us, into their custody at the police station at the airport.
At the police station, Anderson's party was met by officials from the U.S. Embassy who showed the children's visas and other paperwork to police officers. The police, however, were unconvinced of the authenticity of the papers.
At this point, the Customs Border Patrol, the U.S. Customs and Border people are there, the Haitian immigration people are there. They're all arguing and yelling at each other. And the 6 little kids are sitting on the curb in the sun with the 3 of us. So the people from the embassy went back to the embassy to get the paperwork from the Prime Minister, came back, showed it to the police, and they said, we don't think that's really the Prime Minister's signature. And then they said, we want you to produce a brand new letter for the Prime Minister to sign, and we want to see him sign it. And guess what? No one can get a hold of the Prime Minister.
The wrangling went on like that for hours, says Anderson, before the police told them they were free to go, but the children were not. The children, said police, would be transferred into the custody of the Haitian Social Services Agency and were to be sent to a government orphanage on the outskirts of Port-au-Prince. Once there, the children were placed in a tent and the adults were asked to leave.
We asked if we could please stay. No, no, no. Can we sleep on the ground outside? No, absolutely not. Can we at least give the kids dinner and put them to sleep so they're not so freaked out when we leave? No. So to this like horrible screaming, crying fest, they ripped the kids out of our arms and put them on the ground in this tent, and the police escort us out of this compound.
Since Saturday night, Anderson and Maria, the woman from Children of the Promise Orphanage, who has looked after the children all their lives, have been allowed back to visit the children. They are in reasonably good health, says Anderson, but they are anxious and upset. Anderson added that she thinks part of the problem is heightened suspicion after the recent high-profile case of 10 American missionaries who were accused by the Haitian government of trying to take 33 children into the Dominican Republic without the proper paperwork.
The situation's gone from really questionable to quite bad. Like I said, one of the women that's with me is one of the children's adoptive mothers. She's been waiting for him for a long time. She was so excited that she was getting to take him home on Friday. And it's definitely taking a psychological toll on her.
Anderson is staying with a fellow pilot in Port-au-Prince and says she intends to stay in the country until the orphan situation is resolved. In Homer, I'm Aaron Selbig.
Alaska's turned in impressive performances today at the Olympic Games in Vancouver. In hockey, Palmer's Kerry Whelan scored a goal in a 9-1 win over Sweden. The win will advance Team USA to the final game against either Canada or Finland. Whelan is assured of either the silver or bronze medal. And in cross-country skiing, Anchorage's Keegan Randall led the U.S. to a record 6th-place finish in the team skate sprint. She and teammate Caitlin Compton each skied 3 laps of a 1.4-kilometer course. They spent much of the race in 8th place, but Randall came on strong at the finish.
Coming into the final exchange, we were about 6 to 7 seconds down on Canada, which seemed like quite a big gap, but I knew I'd had a strong finish in the semifinals, and so I chased after her and was able to catch Canada coming into the stadium, and so we definitely had a good sprint down the drag strip, but I was able to get ahead of her and take a 6th place for us.
In the end, Canada and the U.S. were separated by just 0.2 seconds. This is what it sounded like on NBC.
It's a race for pride, but this would be a great performance for the United States if they can hang on to for 6th position. Renner trying to move on the side of Randall. Randall fighting her off. It's going to be close at the line.
It looks like it's going to be Keegan Randall beating Canada. They say it's a photo finish.
Germany took gold in the sprint, Sweden silver, and Russia bronze. Randall says it was a hot day to race. The course started out icy but got increasingly mushy as the temperature spiked. She says she knows the crowd was loud in the stadium, but she was so focused on the finish line, she couldn't hear the cheers.
I heard some people say that the roar for me and center runner of Canada duking it out for 6th place was just about as loud as when the Germans and Sweden was going for the gold, so that was kind of fun, an added advantage of the home crowd.
At the Torino Olympics in 2006, Randall led the U.S. to a 10th-place finish in the sprint. She has steadily improved her performance over all 3 Olympics she's competed in.
I'm super happy that we're just getting closer and closer to the medals. This added experience of a 3rd Olympics, just watching people stand on the medals podium, I want that so bad. So it's the fact that we're getting closer is a good confidence boost for the next 4 years.
And the Olympics aren't over for Randall. She will compete in the distance relay on Thursday and the 30-kilometer classic event on Saturday. Alaska Governor Sean Parnell attended a White House meeting this morning with other governors from around the country and heard from President Obama about the economy, health care, and education. Parnell is in Washington for the National Governors Association annual winter meeting. Parnell says despite his political differences with the Democratic administration, his time spent at the White House was productive.
Honestly, the secretaries that I've met with, their doors have been open. The president has been extremely gracious to all of the governors, and I've got no complaints about that. And so my hope is that with the growing access that we have to communicate Alaska's message, that they too will come to appreciate that jobs and economic recovery can happen in Alaska, and we need less federal government intervention to get there.
The governor and his wife were also at the White House last night for a black tie dinner. Despite talking in the past about being at war with the federal government over policies he sees as intrusive, Parnell says the Governors Association members, a mix of Republicans and Democrats, were able to find common ground. He was among 47 governors from states and territories who signed a letter to congressional leaders asking them to extend increased federal spending on Medicaid. It was boosted as part of the Recovery Act stimulus bill signed by the president last year, but is set to expire in December. Parnell says some governors also weighed in on concerns about health care.
As governors, I think we can have an impact on national policy. So when the federal government, through health care legislation, tries to pass unfunded mandates onto the states, we say no. We say give us more flexibility when it comes to Medicaid funds, for example, so that we can tailor those to our residents and the needs of our state.
In addition to meeting with the Secretaries of Interior and Agriculture, Parnell spent time this weekend talking with Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano. He says he wants her to begin thinking about establishing a Coast Guard port in Northeast. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a young man with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder speaks out about his condition.
If I can maybe just get one child, one mother, not to drink during pregnancy, one child to be saved the pain that I am experiencing.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide insurance coverage for Alaskans who may feel they have become uninsurable. It offers hope to people with certain high-risk chronic illnesses or those who have exhausted employer-based insurance, and to some under 65-year-olds who are Medicare eligible. Find out more. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. More information at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
Attorney General Dan Sullivan says the state will retry Michelle Linehan, the former stripper who was convicted for murdering her ex-fiancé. That verdict was overturned earlier this month. Linehan was convicted in 2007 of killing Kent Lepink. Prosecutors have claimed she was inspired by watching the 1994 movie The Last Seduction, in which a woman coaxes her lover into killing her husband for money. The Alaska Court of Appeals ruled February 5th that the trial judge wrongly allowed that connection to be made. The court also said the judge erred in allowing prosecutors to introduce a letter written by Lepping shortly before he was fatally shot. The letter asserted that Linehan would probably be responsible if he died suspiciously. A Denali National Park document is currently in its public comment phase, and it has concession workers in Denali and others scrambling to figure out what they want for the future of the park. It is just part of a multi-phase process that may ultimately determine how much traffic will be allowed on the Denali Park Road. KTNA's Sue Dio has the story.
Denali National Park officials are undertaking one of their most complex management plans to date. They are looking at the one road into the park and how much traffic it can bear, or how much traffic the wildlife can bear. Park spokesperson Chris Pfister says this plan is groundbreaking.
This is a huge undertaking. I don't think there's any place else in the national park system that is looking at determining essentially a carrying capacity for a portion of the park that gets a high public usage.
Close to 400,000 people visit Denali National Park each year. Everyone that arrives at the park gets on either a tour bus or a shuttle bus if they want to travel the park road. Crowding at rest stops and at wildlife stops along the park road, as well as expensive bus tickets and other issues, prodded managers into examining the system. The park road management plan became an environmental impact statement and has been placed high on certain radars across Alaska and the U.S. It examines just how many buses and other vehicles the park road can accommodate and how far on the park road they might travel. Park managers have added an extra step in the EIS that may be confusing. The 30-page document currently out for public review is not a draft, but a list of possibilities that may be included in the future draft EIS. Pfister explains what the workbook examines.
These are concepts for the vehicle transportation systems in the park, i.e. the shuttle bus systems and the tour buses and whatever will come out of this, and also how to manage the other vehicle use on the park road, National Park Service use of it, Kantishna Lodge use of it, contractors.
She assures people it is not an EIS document, and it is a compilation of comments from earlier scoping sessions. The vehicle limit was set over 20 years ago. According to Pfister, it was almost randomly picked as a number in those days, one that seemed unreachable in the mid-80s, and one with no scientific background. There are those that believe in the system and the limits. Alan Siegert is one of the select few who have been at the same job, either as a park road shuttle driver or a tour driver, for over 30 years.
The most striking thing to me about the plan is that it proposes in all but the no action alternative, whatever they're calling that, some really pretty giant changes.
Many park road drivers seem to be in agreement. There needs to be a lot more discussion on many of the points raised in the workbook before it heads to the draft EIS stage. Ron Peck, president and CEO of Alaska Travel Industry Association, represents just one organization of several that are closely watching the process.
The Denali Road Park Plan is very, very important to the visitor industry, obviously, because it's the main source of how over 250,000 visitors experience Denali National Park. So ATIA wants to make sure that all visitor sectors and visitor types are serviced appropriately.
He says the organization is looking not only at the number of buses, but the quality of the tours. Ultimately, park managers are tasked with a seemingly impossible goal, preserving the park and its wildlife, at the same time allowing all 400,000 visitors to experience it. Tour operators, park road drivers, and others hope to get their comments heard about what they want to see in one of Alaska's most visited national parks. They face a looming March 1st deadline to submit ideas and their own concepts. In Talkeetna, I'm Sue Dio.
Alaska Native tribal leaders are gathering in Anchorage this week in an effort to forge consensus on a new look at the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. About 100 people showed up for the meeting, but the absence of Alaska Native corporation leaders was apparent. The meeting was called by the Alaska Intertribal Council. AITC co-chair Mike Williams Sr. was panel moderator. John Schaefer, a Kotzebue elder, told the assembly that 1971's ANCSA took power away from the tribes.
Because Congress did away with tribes up here in Alaska. And what we're trying to do is get that changed. AITC was the one who put it together, but they're only part of the tribes. What we really need to have is all of the tribes, whether they're existing or non-existing, or like the corporations, they're just part of what Congress put together for us. And they need to be there for all of us to support the changes that we need to make.
He says today's Native corporations are not living up to tribal values, such as consulting elders or spending financial gains on the needs of tribal members.
Part of it is because that's the way it was structured, and the corporations were set up as a corporation and not as a tribe. So whatever they set up, that's all they've gotten, and they don't have the responsibility that tribes would have to take care of all of their tribes.
Schaefer says the Obama administration is the first one to listen to the tribes in 40 years. At heart of the issue is Native subsistence rights and the fear that increasingly urbanized Alaska Natives will be shut out of traditional hunting and fishing grounds. Nelson Angapuk, executive vice president of the Alaska Federation of Natives, told the group that federal architects of the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act were more interested in the conservation of animals than the rights of people.
At the time of the environmental impact statements leading to the creation of the conservation systems, included in the environmental impact statement was their concern for the survival of fish and game. Nowhere in those EIS statements was there any mention of the people that reside within those lands.
Angapuk says in the best of both worlds, Alaska Natives living in cities would have the same subsistence rights as those in rural areas. At this time, a federal subsistence rural preference keeps urban Alaska Natives off tribal hunting or fishing grounds on federal land.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ACS. With Android on ACS, an app is available to listen to NPR programming on your phone. Complete details at acsalaska.com. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
Governor Sean Parnell's request for quick legislative action on funding repairs to state buildings around Alaska will not make his goal of passing by March 1st, and the projects it would have kickstarted will likely wait until the full capital projects budget passes near the end of the session in April. Finance co-chair Bill Stoltz, a Chugiak Republican, this morning said it's the administration's own fault.
I don't think the individual departments had adequate explanation or descriptions of their projects. Some of them weren't maintenance projects. They were buying equipment. Some are circumstances of employees within the budget. I think there was would have been support for getting something out early if it was truly a deferred maintenance.
He said legislators should take part in identifying useful projects. They don't need to rely on what he called a mid-level bureaucrat putting a plan together to spend $100 million a year for the next 5 years. Governor Parnell says there's nothing magic about the March 1st deadline, except that by meeting it, the state can make money available to contractors sooner. He says waiting for the later, slower appropriation will put this summer's work at risk, and he's asking legislators to consider the purpose of the early deadline, providing jobs for Alaskans this year.
Bottom line is we should all be in agreement that fixing what we've got, deferred maintenance, that's good. Jobs for Alaskans, our small contractors, our mid-sized contractors, that's good. Let's move.
Director of Management and Budget Karen Rehfeld said even if the bill has stopped, the deferred maintenance plan is not dead. She says the executive branch can prepare in advance for a late arrival and put a rush on the contracting process, getting some of the work on track for July 1st. Seventeen-year-old Morgan Fawcett uses his flute to spread the message that alcohol consumed during pregnancy is the most common known cause of intellectual disabilities. Fawcett should know he suffers from fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. Not everyone afflicted with it shows clear signs of having the disorder, and Fawcett has been able to channel his musical talent with a passion to educate others about FASD and advocate for other victims. He spoke last week at the FASD Southeast Alaska Regional Conference in Juneau. KTOO's Casey Kelly has this profile.
Morgan Fawcett knows he's got most people fooled. Seeing him speak at the FASD conference, you'd never guess his IQ of 73 is considered below average.
Before I even opened my mouth, how many of you thought I was just highly intelligent? Now I like to say, I fooled you. I'm smart enough to fool you, as I was smart enough to fool all my teachers, all the doctors that I was in front of.
Morgan likes to say his last drink was December 9th, 1991, the day his mother was arrested and sent to the Alaska Native Medical Center in Anchorage for the remainder of her pregnancy. When he was 6 months old, his alcoholic father took custody of him, and he grew up in both Juneau and Oregon. He says it was clear early on something was wrong with him. He was born with a submucous cleft palate, making it difficult to eat. He's always been extremely sensitive to light, sound, and touch, and has trouble concentrating. With both his parents' history of substance abuse, Morgan began researching FASD at the age of 14 and soon began seeking a diagnosis.
I did not receive my diagnosis of FASD until I was 15 years old. That is a long time not to know.
In his speech, Morgan publicly admitted for the first time having violent and suicidal thoughts.
I made the decision that I wanted to kill myself, and I wanted to take my father with me, because he was the root of all my pain. I still have the scar on my stomach. I didn't get any further than the cutting myself, but the thought was there. That's how hard it has been for me. How hard is it for someone who's more severe?
Visibly shaking while talking about his battles with depression, Morgan returned to a relative calm after playing the flute for a couple of minutes. He discovered and began playing Native American flute about the same time he was diagnosed as FASD. It would change his life.
Without the flute, I would not be able to come up here and do this for you. Quite frankly, it's very hard for me to do much anything without the flute. It calms me down. It allows my brain to communicate with itself and retrieve information that would be normally very difficult for me to do.
Is it gonna talk?
It also helps that he now has a strong support system in place. Susan Hempel is Morgan's surrogate grandmother, the woman he calls his external brain.
Met Morgan when he was 2, and I don't give up grandkids. I have 14, so he's one of them.
Ironically, Susan came into Morgan's life because of his abusive father, who was once engaged to her daughter. Today, she and her husband Roy help Morgan with everyday activities he's incapable of completing on his own. Hempel says Morgan makes such a good advocate for FASD victims because he's able to communicate how his disorder has affected him.
He knows he's an expert from the inside out, and he's been reading college level and articulating college level since third grade. So he knows that he can, as he so elegantly put it, fool people. Now he has to not fool them, but teach them.
Susan travels with him when he goes to schools and conferences, spreading the word about FASD. Morgan says he does it because he lives with pain every day, and he wants to prevent that from happening to other children.
So it's very important to me to do this, to talk about it, to let everybody know what's going on. This is all caused by prenatal exposure to alcohol, drinking during pregnancy, and it's 100% preventable. So that's why I do it. So if I can maybe just get one child, one mother, not to drink during pregnancy, one child to be saved the pain that I am experiencing is why I do it.
Morgan has publicly forgiven his mother for drinking while he was in the womb. He says he recently accepted her back into his life and is working on his relationship with her. He still has a lot of anger toward his father, whom he's yet to forgive for years of abuse and neglect. He's currently working on his third CD of Native American flute music, which helps support his travels to raise awareness about FASD. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Aaron Selbig in Homer Studio in Talkeetna and Casey Kelly in Juneau. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the Alaska Engineering Fund, whose members include USKH Incorporated, a multidiscipline design firm offering architecture, engineering, planning, and environmental services. Information online at uskh.com. The 2010 BP Teachers of Excellence Program. Nomination forms for teachers are available in local newspapers and at bpteachers.com. Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. ANSEP is the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, where every year Alaska Natives from all corners of the state graduate and become engineers, scientists, and physicians. Students can get involved as early as middle school, then move on to the University of Alaska Anchorage, Fairbanks, or Southeast in a program based on skill building, collaboration, and community. Google ANSEP for more information. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.